That's good to see you all. It's been rich for Max and I to have a chance to speak with you. Appreciate the opportunity in the small groups. In the Big Lebowski, the main character, the dude, Jeffrey Lebowski, speaking to Maude Lebowski, I can't get into the totality of the situation, but at some point, the dude, as he's commonly known, said, "This is a very complicated case, Maud. You know, a lot of ins, a lot of outs, a lot of what have yous, and a lot of strands to keep in my head, man. A lot of strands in old Duder's head." And so the talk this afternoon is about all the strands, the messiness and the complications of Dharma practice. So you remember maybe Cliff Notes, right? It's like the little book that summarizes the whole thing. You know, when I was a kid, I would read that so that I didn't have to read the book, right? And it's a short summary, and it's like whatever. Hamlet then gets mad, or so, you know, and like that's the, you know, that's how it went. And our friend Brian Lesage, he's described, he says, like, look, here on retreat, we're giving you the cliff notes, but you're reading the novel. Yeah. So we give these sort of like, you know, packaged teachings and instructions and invitations. And those are the cliff notes, right? But you're reading the novel. Yeah, to live a day in the life of a practitioner is to read the novel. And the experience of working with suffering can be bewildering. The mind gets scrambled. We feel quite young. Just when suffering hits, we feel young and intimidated. And quite naturally, we turn to techniques, to algorithms and acronyms, yeah? And that is great. This Dharma talk is not my crusade against rain or something like that, you know, against the acronyms that populate our minds these days. It's like, that's great. Rain is from Michelle McDonald, who's like such an exquisite teacher. And so I'm not taking a position against any of that, but just to acknowledge that there are times when the instructions don't quite fit, or it's not clear how to apply them, or they don't work at all. And there are a lot of complexities of in Dharma practice, in living a Dharma life, and a kind of pre-planned technique is useful, but we must also understand that there's a lot of improvisation in practice, a lot of grappling, groping in the kind of dark, in the trenches of our own experience, finding our way. So Miles Davis said something like, if you're not making a mistake, it's a mistake. Yeah. If you're not making a mistake, it's a mistake. We mammals are quite driven to stay oriented to threat and opportunity. And part of how we do that is to narrate our experience. Yeah. And Dharma practice, a retreat, is no different, you know, seems to require the same narration. But we want to be conscious about how we turn our experience, we turn our life, we turn ourselves into a story. And we want to be conscious of the kind of narrative arc of our storytelling, the beginning, middle, end. And so there's an invitation to investigate what am I doing to my experience? In what ways am I imposing a certain narrative structure on what's happening here, on the messiness of experience itself? How am I fashioning my world? And sometimes we really paper over the kind of messiness, the intuitive sense of like, oh, it's messy. We paper over that with like Dharma concepts, yeah? And so we sort of like slap on like, oh, Matthew, I shouldn't cling, or I need to let go, or I should be accepting this, right? But we are clinging, yeah? We are clinging. And slapping on the idea of I should not be clinging sometimes is just like papering over the messiness. And the risk is that practice, it can start to feel a little like pretend, yeah? Do you know those moments when it feels like practice is like a little pretending? And we want to really get sensitive to that sense of pretending, yeah? It's almost like we're performing our meditation for an audience, even though maybe that audience is just you, yeah? Or we're performing for some kind of internalized sense of what of the teacher or the Buddha or something, yeah? But there's a sense of like we're performing for an audience in a certain way. And we feel some the messiness and the kind of Buddhist superhero swoops in to like rescue the moment, yeah, to put things in order. And yeah, it's hard to not freak out when suffering arises. It's hard not to get twisted up by it. Yeah. Not to assume that we've done something wrong, that we've been even visited with suffering in the first place. But when we get into that mode of pretending, when there's maybe we're not being like totally honest with ourselves, with what's happening, we, in a sense, abandon ourselves. There's a measure of alienation in that. So we pretend we're not feeling something we are feeling, or we pretend we're okay with what's happening and we're not okay. And the abandonment itself is painful. Yeah. It's like we're in that gesture of pretending something, like the authentic heart is abandoned. And maybe you know that experience if you're, you know, if you've done practice around mental noting, and sometimes you know you're noting everything, but there's a certain time when, like, oh yeah, you note something and you just like nail it. Yeah, the note is just like, yes. And there's a sense of like, a real relief that you've like encountered with authenticity your experience, and not papered over any messiness, not pretending at all. There's no distortion in it. And it's just like you said yes to it. And I sometimes think about meditation practice as a kind of listening, a deep listening. And we know the experience of being listened to. If you think of somebody who listens exquisitely, you know, maybe you have somebody in your life who just can listen deeply. And there's a sense of like, yeah, you know, there's no distortion in how they're hearing me. There's no, I'm not being misconstrued. And we want to listen to ourselves with that spirit. Yeah. Yeah, of not misconstruing ourselves. This is the Dharma mind. Honest. And something, you know, the moment may still be hard, but something in the heart relaxes in when there's that sense of authentic listening. So, how do we meet the messiness, this complicated case? Well, the first thing, as I was reflecting on the question, was learning when to listen to the teacher and when to ignore them. Yeah. We can err on either side in a way, like sometimes the authority of a teacher being sacrosanct and unquestioned, and that can be functional for a while, but not forever. Yeah. Can be functional for a while, but not forever. And then on the other time, there are other times when people really don't listen to the teachers at all. You know, sometimes I have the experience of like somebody, I say something, you know, and, you know, suggests somebody does something, and they actually try it. They try what I suggest and it actually helps. And then they come back and report that. And we're both kind of amazed, you know, like you did what I said and it actually helped. And here we are. And yeah, okay, good, right? We can err on either side of never listening, of always listening. And the invitation in dealing with the messiness, in improvising, is to give a kind of sincere, non-skeptical try, to take an adequate dose of the medicine and to see what resonates with your system. Yeah. Sometimes it's just a word that from the teachings or a phrase, and you say like something in the heart says yes, and you follow that. But you also have to feel empowered not to try to implement something that doesn't feel native to your heart. So we deal with the messiness by not urgently mapping out the path of our own redemption. Yeah. Like when I used to do clinical research and it was involved with clinical trials, yeah. And of medications or potential medications. And there are often a couple questions. The first question is like, okay, does this medicine work? And if it does work, then the second question is, how does it work? Yeah, what's the mechanism of action? Yeah. And we are often kind of obsessed with the mechanism of our own liberation. Yeah. That is, in every moment, we're discerning how it's all working. We're trying to know that in every moment it's moving in the right direction. We want to convince ourselves that we're doing it right, you know, that we're doing it right and it's worth doing. And so we're trying to like plot out the path, you know, moment by moment. And it reminds me of something Sharon Salzberg said. Like she said early in her path of practice, she said, you know, I was trying to do the practice and make it work. And the realization is, oh, I can just do the practice. Yeah. The rest is added. But it's hard not to plot out. It's almost like this is how we justify the challenge of Dharma practice, is that we sort of fit it into a kind of narrative arc. Each moment has its place in this movement towards freedom. And there's a way that we kind of compulsively are reiterating that to ourselves, as if we're running a little behavioral modification program on ourselves. Like, it's okay, Matthew, keep going. Yeah. You're getting a little freer. You're getting a little freer, right? And there's a way that, we have to take our hands off the reins. So we tolerate a measure of not knowing, of not knowing. The path of Vipassana is about knowing. Knowing is celebrated, but it's also about not knowing, about equanimity with not knowing. And as I was saying, we associate being oriented so closely with safety, yeah, being oriented to opportunity and threat, being oriented to pleasure and pain, that it's hard, sometimes even frightening, to let go of the reins, to start to become more disoriented. But the moment is not oriented. So we, in the face of this kind of anxiety about not knowing, we kind of try to plow through the confusion, the not knowing prematurely. I had friends when I lived in Los Angeles years ago, many years ago, who would occasionally gather and do an all night sitting, you know, just stay up all night and practice, not on, sometimes on retreat, but often just not even on retreat. And and so they would practice through the night, and they would note, they would make mental notes, except the difference was they weren't just making mental notes silently, they were making notes out loud, yeah? Every time they would note, they would say the note out loud. And so all of them say, you know, you can imagine the madness of this, right? And sometimes there would be only one note. Yeah. Not burning, you know, reaching, intending, you know, all of this. It would be one note for the entire night. And the note would be, don't know. Yeah. In the face of every sensory arising, the note was, don't know. Yeah. Wisdom requires a toleration of not knowing, of not reaching for knowing, but more like creating conditions where wisdom can bubble up. This is Ken MacLeod. A few times in my life, I've been in difficult situations, situations in which I could not see any way forward. In my morning practice sessions, I would, to the best of my ability, rest in the confusion that swirled inside me. I suppose it was the years of effort that made such resting possible, even though all those years, those efforts had seemed paltry and ineffective. When I could rest in the confusion, it grew quiet and dark, a kind of quiet of a night with no moon or stars. As I rested in that darkness, a clarity would sometimes arise, and with it a sense of direction. How I or what discerned that clarity or that direction, I don't know, but both were there. The clarity didn't illumine anything. It didn't make anything in the situation clearer. It just indicated a direction. Where that direction or what I would encounter, I had no idea. There was a direction, nothing more. The Dharma is said to be the middle path between unwholesome extremes, between self-mortification on the one hand and self-indulgence on the other. But part of the messiness of the path of practice is that it's not just the middle path between unwholesome extremes, it's the middle path between, within wholesome extremes. Yeah. So it's a path between effort and relaxation, between love and wisdom, between seriousness and play, between compassion and equanimity, between caring and not caring. And this is complicated. This is messy. It is messy. It would be so much easier if it were, you know, if it were simple, yeah? If it were just one or the other. But the Dharma is often found between two, yeah? Within two. Within maybe paradox, as Max was saying. It's not, if it would be so simple if it were merely the instruction that we could take to heart was just to escape samsara or save samsara. It would be clear what we would do, clearer. But it's both. And that means it's complicated. And, you know, I've realized that, you know, the lineage, the lineage of monasticism, of Asian monasticism is very potent in all that we're doing. And it's important, yeah, it's important to remember, as we're encouraged to remember, that the Buddha was a monk. You know, the Buddha was a renunciate. It's not like an incidental part of his spiritual gesture. And I certainly have enormous reverence for the monastic lineage and for the forms that lay folks like myself have inherited. And becoming more and more conscious that to actually translate a monastic renunciate tradition requires some more sophisticated efforts on our part to really understand, like, what that life means for lay life. What are the lessons to learn? What are the lessons not to learn? And so it is messy. It is messy. It is a real question, and it's a pressing question in this time to grapple with the kind of power of the monastic lineage and the questions of, like, what does goodness entail? What are the ethics of an engaged lay life? Yeah. It's not clear exactly. We are exploring together. And with all of the not knowing and all of the patience that I'm suggesting and all of the ambiguity, the complications, the messiness, through all of that, we are supported by faith. Yeah. We really weather the kind of messiness with the background support of faith. Yeah. like Max was saying, like Dhamma, that which supports a certain way. There's a faith that holds us through this. And faith is, Ajahn Amaro said, it's not filling the unknown with belief. It is tracing out the implications of our own direct experience. It does not have a kind of dogmatic feel to it. Alan Watts just said, belief clings, faith lets go. Yeah. We start to sense in amidst all the messiness to the rightness of one's efforts. Yeah. That on this path, there is something here for me. Yeah. There's something here for me. Vaclav Havel said, hope's not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. Ajahn Sajito said, described faith as like a hinge point in the practice. Yeah, like once that hinge is installed, the door is gonna swing open. And faith is that hinge, yeah. Says, the riddle of the stuck place is that it's something that we can't negotiate in our normal mode of operating. If it could be done by a me, it wouldn't be that which goes beyond me. What is required is a change in direction and a change in energy. There can be an opening into something larger, more kindly, more boundness than the self mechanisms. We get beyond the attachment to ups and downs of our personality. We get beyond attachment to the systems and techniques of the Dhamma. And we get clear of the doubt that measuring Dhamma in these terms will always bring us. As we move past these inevitable attachments, we become spacious and at peace. We are, in a sense, surrendering the meditator, the Buddhist, to the practice itself. Yeah. And taking a certain kind of refuge in the sense of the wholesomeness, the rightness or maybe just that there are no other real alternatives, yeah. Where what you have to do and want to do converge. Now, all this said, there are still sometimes points in practice where nothing works. Nothing works. No matter what you do, at some point, if you practice intensively, if you practice intensively over a period of time, no matter what you do, at some point the practice will bring you to your knees. And it's important for us to know, and I say this reverentially, to know the places of desperation inside us. At some point we do get a dose of the experience of deep of powerlessness. Sometimes it's a small dose and sometimes it's a very big dose. It feels like too big a dose. And the ego is all out of moves. Sort of all its moves, all the places it goes, it's all out of moves. And all we can do is just put one foot in front of the other. The sense of helplessness is, it's among the most potent in the whole array of human experiences. It runs so perfectly opposite to our evolutionary conditioning, our search for control and security. And sometimes in the face of that that powerlessness, we try to gain control by assigning blame, you know, self, other, the world. I'm thinking about a loved one here, for him, he has lived a very highly controlled life, and almost miraculously, it's worked out pretty well. But in a way that has merely compounded the habit of maintaining control, a sense of agency, possession. And so when he senses helplessness, when he senses the desperation, the abject poverty in which we find ourselves in some moments, all he knows how to do is place blame somewhere and becomes fiercely self-critical. And in a way, the self-criticism is just a kind of mirage that there is any control. It's like the placing of blame conceals the illusion that it's actually blameless. But to know the blamelessness of it is to know the helplessness of it. And these moments, when the ego is all out of moves, they can be humiliating, but the invitation is for them merely to be humbling rather than humiliating. It is, in fact, an opportunity for a very deep insight into the First Noble Truth. Yeah, we miss that. We skip over it. Michelle McDonald says sometimes people are like in the insight of it and not catching it, just missing it, getting caught in it. But the insight is like a stone's throw away, opening to dukkha. And when nothing works, when nothing works, when the practice gets so messy, and this happens in small ways in each day, probably, in big ways, maybe a few times in one's life, yeah? But in small ways, much more frequently. And knowing helplessness, knowing it with clarity, knowing it with pristine clarity, shows us the importance of kindness. Because nobody needs kindness more than someone helpless. And this becomes this like encounter with ourselves, with the places of desperation. It becomes a wellspring of compassion. Yeah. And it consolidates our motivation to practice. This is how we redeem dukkha. And so it's a messy path. It's a messy path. But the messiness does not diminish the grace and beauty and wonder and value of walking it. Let's just sit for a moment. So thank you. Thanks for your attention. And as always, please pick up what's useful, what feels native to your heart, and leave behind whatever does not. It's good to practice with you. See you in a bit.